Good morning. I'm going to call to order the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division meeting. We do have a quorum, and the clerk will note the roll. So, Representative Brand, can I get the March 28th minutes?
Yeah, good morning, Madam Chair. I move the minutes from March 28th, 2019.
Right, those minutes are in your packets, so members, if you have any questions or changes, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. And so I want to welcome you. It's a beautiful, sunny day we have here in the state capitol. And for this meeting, I appreciate that everybody is going to be engaged in the topic of the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill. And so I just wanted to make a couple of notes before we actually go through it, to make a couple of comments. And one is, first of all, to let everyone know that we have the best team of staff people that I think any committee has. We start with Mr. Savory, who has done just remarkable work for us. We have Mr. Sullivan, who's been doing great work and has listened to variations on a theme over and over again from me, so I appreciate that. We have great partisan staff, Mr. Nisley, who's not here, so I'll have to state this again when he's here. But, you know, Mark has been a part of this committee for a number of years, and I really appreciate that he does bring that kind of stability to understanding what the issues are. So it's good to have him. The staff who sit next to me, Nancy Conley and Carl Kazi, are just delightful and knowledgeable and skilled and capable and good sounding boards, and I really appreciate the work that they've been doing. And we have good pages as well. So Ben and Seaver have been doing all of the work. And our researcher on the DFL side, Mr. Smith. So Bennett has been, you know, he kind of jumped into this, although he has an ag background. To come in and be a researcher is something new as well, so that's a good thing. For all of us, and you know, I think that that's something that we want to make sure that we acknowledge in every committee, because the work they do, they're here longer hours than we are, and we're here long hours. So they do really good work, and I appreciate everything that they're doing. The Department of Ag has really good staff as well, and I know that Commissioner Peterson will be able to acknowledge the people that work with him. And I appreciate that. And I'm going to just say, you know, Representative Hamilton isn't yet here, but he always says ag is a noble profession. And I think truly we do all believe that as we sit around the table. I also believe that public service is a noble profession. And those of us who are elected understand what it means to go through the process of knocking on doors and meeting with people and you know, gathering input and being able to sit at this table is just a wonderful opportunity for us. And it's something I think we should not take lightly. We do have the opportunity and the obligation to represent the people of our districts, of our region, and of the state. And as we do that, sometimes we might get a little engaged in a topic that we believe strongly in, but maybe the other side doesn't believe quite in the same way. And that kind of engagement is important for us to have a good product in the end, and for us to continue to meet where we can and to differ when we must. And I think that's important for us to acknowledge as well. So in this bill, we may have some single issues that people would oppose or say that isn't quite right. There may be bigger issues, there may be small issues, but we are here to bring forward an omnibus ag finance bill that addresses traditional agriculture and emerging agriculture, and how we can value all, and we can make some changes, perhaps some direction that we may not always know what the vision is ahead of us, but we have to work toward that, and that's something I think we're doing. So as I reflect on the lessons learned this year, I think there's what I would say is there's no one right answer, no one right approach to things. I think that I have learned maybe more recently, but over the course of the last number of months, that differing views and perspectives is important to the process. And I acknowledge that we have had differing views and perspectives, and that's what we're here to do, is to be able to understand where somebody else might be coming from and what their perspective is, but also to value that and not diminish that and respect that. And I appreciate that we have had really good, thoughtful discussion. We've had some things where, you know, one person might, frown a little bit and think, well, how did they come to that conclusion? But it's been helpful and I think enlightening for us to be able to listen, understand each other, hopefully come to a better perspective ourselves maybe. And we should always know that perhaps we're not always right, but that also doesn't mean that somebody who might be in opposition to us is always wrong. So trying to understand that we come to it from a different perspective and being respectful and thoughtful and engaged has served us well over the last couple of months. I expect it's going to serve us well this week, and it will serve us well into the future. So I appreciate that we have really good conversations, and we'll have ongoing conversations. Today we'll be able to hear about what is in this bill. We will be walking through it. Our nonpartisan staff will be able to provide us with the language and the spreadsheet and talk about that. We will invite testimony today, so people will be able to come forward and say again what they like or what they don't like about this bill, about what we're proposing here. Amendments will be due by tomorrow morning at 9:45. And if we don't have any computer glitches, things will be able to be posted. I know we had some issues maybe this morning with that, but we will be voting on the bill on Thursday. And so your amendments will be due tomorrow morning by 9:45. Then by Thursday, we'll be able to have the bill and be able to go through that. So right now, we do have the Delete Everything Amendment to House File 2200. That is the DE4 that's in front of us. And just before the staff gets started on that, I'm going to ask, does anybody have any questions about kind of what we're going to be doing, how this is going to go? Okay. So I just want to talk about the researchers. Bennett is doing a great job. Mr. Nicely, you missed. You'll have to listen to the tape. I did say good things about you. So
I'll have to listen to it.
All right. Thank you. When we walked through this bill before, we did not have House File 2200 before us, so I know you have that in your packet as well. So I'm just going to move House File 2200 to get the bill before us. On Thursday, we'll actually do the DE amendment and put that on, and then we'll have the other amendments as we're walking through that. So with no other questions, then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Sullivan, if he would please walk us through the bill.
Madam Chair and members, I'll start the walkthrough on page 1 of the DE4 and note that a lot of the language is carryover from House File 2200, the governor's agriculture budget proposal as introduced, and I'll highlight the changes. I won't spend time on the numbers unless they're something within a rider that's worth flagging for members. Mr. Savory will go through the spreadsheet, and his spreadsheet compares the chair's proposal.
Mr. Sullivan, can I just interrupt you a moment? We can't really hear you that well, so we're going to make sure that your mic is on, I think.
Yeah, thank you, Madam
Hamilton.
And Madam Chair, and just to be clear, we're working on the DE4 amendment, not on the House File 2200.
Thank you. That is correct. Yes. So we moved the 2200 to put it before us, but we're working off of the DE4, and we will move that on Thursday.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that clarification, and hopefully now the mic is a little bit stronger. Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, can everyone hear me okay? Just to recap quickly, Mr. Savory is going to go through the spreadsheet after this, so I won't spend a lot of time focusing on the numbers in the DE, but we'll leave that portion of the walkthrough for him to cover. So members will turn to page 2 of the DE4. One technical difference that members will notice is that the DE4 includes riders for all of the change items or the increases in spending over base that were in the governor's budget proposal and that are also carried in the DE4. So paragraphs B through I on pages 2 and 3 are language that simply characterizes the change items and what the increased funding in the different budget areas, in this case in the protection services area, would be spent on. So that, members go then on to page 4. Again, paragraphs A and B on page 4 under agricultural marketing and development, those weren't in the House file as introduced, but they simply are riders that explain what the additional funding over base is for in this subject area. And there's a note then, if members look at page 4.19, they'll note that of the $75,000 per year to the Department of Agriculture for rural mental health activities, $12,000 each year would be to provide professional development training for farm business management instructors. And that $12,000 of the $75,000 is one time. So the base in the future would be $63,000 per fiscal year. Moving on, these are rest of the language on pages 4 and 5. These are base riders, or in other words, language that's typically carried in every ag budget bill. So there's no change to note there. On to page 6. This is the budget area that includes AGREET and AGRI. One change of note is on line 6.29. The bill as introduced specified that up to $1,000 each year was for avian influenza. $1 million per fiscal year for the University of Minnesota to spend on avian influenza research. This language increases that amount to $2.5 million and expands the purposes to include African swine fever and chronic wasting disease as well. Then members move to page 7, paragraph B, starting on line 7.5. This is the AGRI, or the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Program rider. There's a little difference in this language from the bill as introduced and from Laws 2017. On line 7.15, this is new to specify an amount up to $450,000 for farm-to-school activities. The department has spent money under AGRI for farm-to-school in the past, but this establishes a higher amount of money, I believe, than what the department has allocated in recent fiscal years for farm-to-school, and specifies that this money could also be used in the next 2 years for reimbursing schools for purchases from local farmers. That's on line 7.20. Another difference, 7.24, the amount is increased, the cap for urban agriculture from $250,000 in the bill as introduced to $350,000 per fiscal year. It's also an increase on 7.28 for the allocation. The cap for good food access spending under AGRI, that's up to $350,000 each year from $250,000 in the bill as introduced. Next, move to page 8. This is still the rider, very long rider for the AGRI program. It continues on page 8. One change is that the bill as introduced specified that the $1 million per year under AGRI for distribution to county fairs and the $1.5 million each year for the bioeconomy incentive payments, that those were one-time allocations within AGRI, so they would not be in the base in future fiscal years. But in the DE amendment, that one-time language is removed. So the intent is that this allocation within AGRI would continue into fiscal years 22 and 23. Moving on then to page 9, beginning on 9.12, this is language from Chair Poppe's House File 1351 that provides grants for installation of equipment necessary to store and dispense E15, blend of 15% ethanol, 85% conventional gasoline. That language continues through the bottom of page 9 and through about halfway through page 10, ends on 10.22. That's language from the bill laying out the parameters of the grant program and the reporting that's required. Then beginning on 10.23 in the administration and financial assistance or pass-through grant, portion of the budget. New language on 10.32, this is from Representative Lippert's House File 1616, providing a grant to Greater Mankato Growth Incorporated. And on the top of page 11 is new language, $25,000 each year for grants to a nonprofit to provide a legal assistance hotline for farmers. And that $25,000 per year is one time, or just in fiscal 20 and 21, as specified in the DE. Rest of the language are base or standard continuation riders from previous budgets to the bottom of 11. And on to page 12, the bill has introduced continued funding for Second Harvest Heartland to purchase milk for distribution to food shelves and food banks, and other to also purchase other ag commodities, surplus ag commodities that would otherwise be discarded or sold in a secondary market. This language that starts on 12.6 is from Representative Wozlowick's House File 1096. And what this language does is it combines the two programs, the two Second Harvest grant programs, into one, and provides a total then of $1.7 million per fiscal year, and gives then Second Harvest some discretion on how that $1.7 million each year is allocated between milk and other ag commodities. But members will see on line 13.10 on the next page, the bill does specify that although there's flexibility to allocate the money each fiscal year, no less than $600,000 may be allocated for milk purchases for distribution to food shelves and food banks, and that's $50,000 increase over the base and the amount proposed, $550,000 in the bill as introduced. That $50,000 increment is one time, so members will see lines 13.22 to 13.24. The base in future fiscal years for the Second Harvest money goes back down to $1.65 million per fiscal year. On farther down on page 13, there's a continuation of funding for the Center for Rural Policy and Development. The DE provides that there's an additional $50,000 over base in the first year of that grant to the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and specifies that that money is for a community solar garden study. There's a typo on line 13.29 in the DE. That should read section 23 rather than section 22. And I'll discuss that section when we get to that in the walkthrough. And then on the bottom of page 13, 13.32, is this is a base or continuing allocation grants for the Minnesota Agricultural Education and Leadership Council, or MALC. There's an additional $40,000 above base in the first fiscal year, and the purpose for that is specified on top of page 14. Starting on 14.1, the $40,000 the first year is for MALC to develop a farm transitions curriculum. Then we get on 14.7 to appropriations, now moving past the Department of Agriculture and to the Board of Animal Health. Again, the change items that weren't specified in the bill as introduced are designated in paragraphs A and B. These are, Mr. Savory will go over how these numbers compare to the board's proposal, but these are the two areas that they asked for additional funding in B and C to improve oversight of farm survey and for agricultural emergency preparedness and response work. The rider on in paragraph C, starting on 14.14, this is new. This is an appropriation from the account where the board deposits the inspection fees it collects under the Farm Survey Program. And that money is appropriated by statute back to the board under current law to carry out the Farm Survey Program. This language specifies that of that amount, of the amount in that account, the inspection fee revenue, $6,000 each year is to develop electronic forms to better track farm survey movement and record keeping. That's the end of the appropriation language for the Board of Animal Health under AURI, Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. That's the rider that is the governor's request for increased funding for AURI, and no other changes. And then we get to statutory language then, starting with Section 5 on 14.25. This is from Representative Hansen's House File 1292. which increases penalties assessed by the Department of Agriculture against those who apply pesticides resulting in damage to off-site or adjacent state parks, state forests, or other land within the state's outdoor recreation system. That goes through the end of 15 and on to page 16, where we get section 6. This is Representative Tabke's House File 2293, and it governs the license fee that's paid by a contractor providing custodial services in MnDOT rest areas. That's language that the members recognize, same as in the bill as introduced in House File 2293, I should say. On to page 17, this is language that concerns the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council from Representative Anderson's House File 47, with a few changes from the bill that the committee heard earlier this session. The extension in House File 47, the proposal was to extend to the Fertilizer Council the 40-cent per ton fertilizer surcharge that funds its research grants and its grant program by 10 years. In the DE, starting, for example, on line 17.10, the AFREC would be extended. In this case, the fertilizer surcharge of 40 cents per ton is extended by 5 years to 2024. Similar five-year extension on line 17.21. And then there's some other changes in the DE to the AFREC program. Line 17.27, and in conjunction with section 10, which begins on 17.28, they provide that the Fertilizer Council may award up to 10% of grant dollars each year for fertilizer projects that concern metropolitan or non-agricultural fertilizer use. So 17.27 requires then the outreach and dissemination of research findings to metropolitan fertilizer users. And on page 18 is the up to 10% authority language, 18.6 and 18.7. And then sections 11 and 12 are also AFREC extensions, five-year extension to the grant program and to the dedicated account that holds the 40-cent per ton surcharge proceeds. Section 13, beginning on 18.12, that's the second section in Representative Hansen's House File 1292, providing double penalty for certain pesticide applications. Then section 14, beginning on 18.18, this is Representative Hansen's House File 1908 that concerns labeling of nursery stock and plants that have been treated with a systemic pesticide. That language continues down through 19.20, and then section 15 on 19.21 is the beginning of a couple of sections concerning industrial hemp. These are from Representative Vang's House File 1660. The first section extends the definition of industrial hemp to match the new 2018 Federal Farm Bill definition of hemp, which includes not only the plant but also seeds, derivatives, extracts, etc., from the industrial hemp plant. On the top of page 20, then, section 16 is also from Representative Vang's bill, specifying that it's also lawful in Minnesota to possess hemp that's grown, lawfully grown, produced in another state. Then section 17, beginning on 20.6, that's Representative Anderson's House File 453, concerning how the Department of Agriculture calculates the food handler license fee, the sales-based license fee for liquor stores. And in specific directs the department to exclude the liquor store's gross sales of off-sale alcoholic beverages when determining the food handler license fee. The bottom of page or middle of page 20, line 20.18, these are a series of extensions of existing appropriation authority that were requested by the Department of Agriculture in House File 2020. This goes all the way back to laws 2015 and an appropriation for the Agri program. The department has asked for one additional fiscal year to spend that money. And so there's a lot of carryover language that with no changes, but the changes on page 23.2, you see that's merely asking for one additional year to spend a portion of that Agri appropriation from 2015. That old language continues then unchanged through page 26. Starting on 26.27, the Department of Agriculture has requested that of a Laws 2017 appropriation for compensation for farmers whose livestock are crippled or destroyed by wolves, they're asking for the authority on 28.1 to be able to spend up to $5,000 of the second year appropriation to reimburse University of Minnesota Extension for its assistance under that program. And then on to page 29.18, it's another request for an extension of authority to spend previously appropriated agri money, in this case from the most recent current ag budget law in 2017. That change is on page 32.35. That's the end of the appropriation extension request in the DE. Then we begin a series of required reports on 33.25. This is an industrial hemp report, and it's also there's a component in here from Representative Vang's House File 1660. Directing the Department of Agriculture to apply to USDA under authority provided in the 2018 Farm Bill to request primary regulatory authority over industrial hemp in this state. If the Department of Ag doesn't apply, then USDA would retain control and authority to regulate industrial hemp in the state of Minnesota. Then paragraph B on 33.30, this is new language that requires the Department of Agriculture in consultation with the Departments of Public Safety and Health to develop a regulatory framework for THC that results from industrial hemp processing. And the Department of Ag would report this framework, this proposed regulatory framework, back to this and this comparable Senate committee by February 15th of next year. On page 34.4, section 22, this is new language requiring the Department of Agriculture to report back to this committee and our counterpart in the Senate regarding how best to cultivate and support beginning farmers, with priority given to certain beginning farmers, those who are women, veterans, and members of communities of color. And when the department prepares this report, it would be required to consult the Department of Employment and Economic Development and consider development of a next-generation farmer internship program. Section 23 is from Representative Hansen's House File 1796. This is the language, I think it was $25,000 per fiscal year, that was mentioned earlier, that would go to the Center for Rural Policy and Development for a study of the economic benefits of community solar gardens for farmers and local farm economies. $50,000, Mr. Savory tells me. And the change from Representative Hansen's bill is that instead of the Department of Agriculture performing their report, it would be the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Otherwise, the language is very similar to the language members heard in Representative Hansen's bill. Then moving on to page 35, it's Article 2. These are sections that pertain to farm survey as implemented by the Board of Animal Health. And these are sections are based on Representative or Chair Poppy's House File 2200A1 amendment that she presented to the committee last week. I'll just note a couple of changes from that language that the committee heard. 35.22, this in the DE, newborn cervid animals would need to be identified within 24 hours of birth. That's a change from the language members saw last week. Another change is on page 36. The fees, the annual fee. There's a new fee category in the DE. It's actually on the top of page 37. The annual fee would be $650 if the herd consists of more than one cervid species. Then on farther down on page 37, this language is different from what members heard last week, 37.16. It's intended to be a three-year moratorium for new registrations to possess white-tailed deer, with language specifying that this moratorium is not intended to prohibit transfer of a valid registration or sale between family members in certain circumstances. And still on page 37, a change on 37.26. Under current law, the owner of the farm survey has 2 weeks to report any animal movement off the premises. That would decrease under the DE to 48 hours with the window for notification with the Board of Animal Health. And then starting on 37.27, there would be a 72-hour statewide movement prohibition when an animal tests positive for chronic wasting disease in the state. That continues at the bottom of page 37 and the top of page 38. And another change from last week's language, 38.18, if a chronic wasting disease is confirmed on an animal on the premises in the state, then before the person who owns that land sells or transfers it to someone else, that owner would be required to disclose that the property is subject to certain restrictions and posting requirements and fencing maintenance requirements for 5 years. The requirements were in the language discussed last week, but the disclosure requirement on 38.18 to 38.21 is new in the DE. So is the Section 8 on 38.22. This is a requirement for the Board of Animal Health to report back to the legislature by February 1st of next year regarding the board's progress in implementing recommendations in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's 2018 Program Evaluation Report on the Farm Servant Program. And then the rest of the bill is language that members have already heard with no changes. Articles 3 concerning grain buyers and Article 4 concerning grain elevators or grain storage. This is language from Representative Anderson's House File 915, in particular the DE1 amendment that he offered and the committee adopted on the 21st of March. Madam Chair, then that is the remainder of the DE.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. I'll turn it over now to Mr. Savory because we have also the spreadsheet to go through. So, Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, I'll be working from two documents this morning, document number one being the larger multi-page spreadsheet, and then I also have a smaller supplemental spreadsheet that will go dive a little deeper into the Agri program, and I'll let members know when I switch over to that as we move towards that section of the appropriations and the bill. I'll just start kind of at the top of the page on the larger spreadsheet. Speaking specifically to lines 5, 6, and 7, I'll be speaking primarily from the right-hand two columns, which are titled DE Amendment, the first column being for 20 and 21, the second column being for fiscal years 20 and 23. And then for comparison, there is also a smaller column all the way on the right-hand side, which is the differences between this DE Amendment as proposed and the 2020 base, or 20 and 21 base. Overall appropriations for the Department of Agriculture for 20 and 21 total $110,195,000. And the tails, they are totaling $108,714,000. The Board of Animal Health totals in 20 and 21 $11.8 million, and then in the tails, $12.1 million. Line 7, AURI in the 2021 biennium totals $7.7 million. And then in the tail, $7.8 million. In total, the numbers which are specific to the bill, in total that is $129.8 million in the current in the budget biennium, and then $628,000 in the tails biennium. Line 12 is a reference to Representative Anderson's bill regarding liquor licenses. That bill does cause a slight revenue loss to the general fund, and so that negative $3,000 in 20 and 21 and into the tails is accounted for there. And then when you total up that loss, the price or the amount in which this bill costs is on line 13, which is the total net general fund spending is $129,832,000 and then $128,674,000 in the tails. And that over on the right-hand side is $7.580 million above the base, which coincidentally is the committee's target for 20 and 21. Because Mr. Sullivan did so much of the larger part of the bill. I'm just going to go over the change items that are relevant to each specific area of the department, the Board of Animal Health, and AURI. Line 43 is the transfer to the Ag Emergency Account, a one-time transfer of $325,000. Line 44 is appropriation or our appropriations for the Incident Management Team, $300,000 each year on a permanent basis. Line 45 are transfers to the Noxious Weed Account and the Ag Fund, or these are pasture grants that communities would receive, and that is $375,000 in each year into the tails. Line 46 is another part of the Noxious Weed Program. This is for the admin and staff piece, and that's $525,000 each year in this biennium and in the tails. Line 47 is increase to the meat inspection program. That is the same as the governor's request at $150,000 each year on a permanent basis. Line 48 is another governor's request, or the same as the governor's request, $300,000 each year for the industrial hemp development program. Line 49 are appropriations regarding the critical core capacity of plant pathogens and pests, and that is $250,000 in each year. This matches the governor's request. Line 50 is the capital equipment replacement request for the ag laboratory. The DE amendment funds that at $650,000 in fiscal year 20, and then the appropriation changes to $150,000 in fiscal year 21. Ongoing appropriations for that particular particular line item are $154,000 in each year going forward. And then line 51, Mr. Sullivan referenced it in his walkthrough, but there is the $5,000 carve out for payments to University of Minnesota staff that work within the wolf depredation area. We'll slide down to line 67, which are non-general fund change items. Line 68 represents the $150,000 federal match that the department will potentially receive for increasing the meat inspection program from the general fund. That's $150,000 in each year going forward. Line 69 represents the grain buyer inspection fee changes. Representative Paul Anderson's bill that Mr. Sullivan talked about at the end of his presentation. If you examine the fee structure as of now, they net out to each other, so there'll be no impact from a revenue perspective on those changes. And so that's why there's a dash there instead of an actual number. Line 70 is the pesticide penalty enhancement, Representative Hansen's bill. The department estimates a small $1,000 increase at this time for that particular penalty increase. And that's carried forward in the details. So we'll flip the page over and go down to the promotion and marketing area, which starts on line 83. And then line 94 and 95 are the differences that Mr. Sullivan referenced. Line 94 being the agricultural trade and marketing to expand domestic and international markets at $200,000 per year in 20 and 21 and going into the base. And then also the farmer mental health outreach and 24-hour hotline is on line 95, which is $75,000 in the 20 and 21 biennium in each year. And then that appropriation drops slightly to $63,000 going into the tails in each year. We'll go slide down a little more. That concludes the promotion and marketing piece. And I'll just talk about the AGREET section of the bill, and then we'll switch to the smaller spreadsheet. If you look at line 115, that's the AGREET appropriation of $9.3 million each year. That is not changed from the base or from the governor's recommendations. Line 116 is the rapid response, which is going unchanged, $600,000 each year of the agreed amount. Line 117, Mr. Sullivan already referenced, a $1.5 million increase to the U of M avian flu research transfer, and also expands the purpose to allow for work regarding swine fever and CWD. That's on line 117. Line 118 remains unchanged, which is the Farm Business Management MALC appropriation within AGREET to $2 million per year. And then lines 119 and lines 120 are appropriations regarding of the amount for AGREET regarding wild rice and potato breeding. Those are $450,000 each year and $350,000 each year and those have remained unchanged. And so I'll just quickly switch over to the smaller spreadsheet that will dive into the agri section. Of the smaller spreadsheet, you'll see that the appropriation for agri is on line, on line three. When you compare that, when you compare the base, the governor, and the DE amendment, the appropriation remains exactly the same, which is $14.275 million per year. Lines 6 and 7 represent designated spending, where the bill instructs the department to spend a specific amount of money regarding activities. And so line 6 is the county fairs. As Mr. Sullivan noted earlier, the DE amendment makes the county fairs as a base item going forward at $1 million per year. And then line 7, the biofuel incentive payments are $1.5 million per year on a permanent basis going forward. And then line 9, I'll switch down. These are to the allowable spending, which is in reference to dollars that have a cap. And you'll see the language phrase often uses up to a specific amount. And so if you look at line 10, agri compared to the governor and to the base, the DE amendment increases the urban youth agriculture piece to $350,000 per year in 20 and 21 and going forward. The Good Food Access Program is at $350,000 each year and going forward. And then also on line 12, there's language referencing value-added agriculture grants. That's $2 million, up to $2 million per year and going forward. And then finally on line 13, the farm-to-school program, which, as Mr. Sullivan referenced, was not in the governor's request, but it's something the department already does, and that's $450,000 per year and going forward into the tails. And for a comparison on line 15, both the base, the governor, and the DE amendment all reference 6.5% for administrative spending for the agri program. And so I'll quickly switch back to the larger spreadsheet and continue on page 2. Mr. Sullivan referenced line 133, which is the biofuel dispenser cost share grants at the one-time appropriation of $325,000 in fiscal year 20. And then members may would note that on line 131, jumping up a couple lines, the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation grants. In prior bills, that grant was in this section of the bill, but has been since moved to the administration section, and we'll see that in a couple minutes. And then flipping the page, I'll finish off the Department of Ag with the administration section. The changes are on line 174, a $137,000 per year base increase for the Minsky Mental Health Grants. That brings the total appropriation to $250,000 per year. And then going down onto line 177 is the Farm Advocates Program increase. That's an increase of $47,000 per year. That $47,000 is added to the base already in law. And then line 178 is the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Mr. Sullivan referenced the $50,000 increase for that on a one-time basis. Line 179 is the increase of $50,000 per year on a one-time basis for the milk grants. Line 180 is the Greater Mankato Growth Initiative, a $75,000 one-time appropriation. Line 181 is the newly moved Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, which has been moved to the admin section, so that's $25,000 per year in 2021 and going forward into the tails. Line 182 is a legal assistance hotline grants. Line 183 is the one-time mail seat increase of $40,000 in fiscal year 20. And then line 184 represents just kind of a footnote regarding the combination of both second harvest programs into one program. And so you'll see $1.7 million in each year in brackets because that funding is already there. We're just combining them. And then you'll see in the tails in 22 and 23 that has been reduced by the one-time appropriation for milk. So that goes returns to the base. And then we'll proceed further If members are interested, lines 222 to 231 represent the total funding per account. So, example, you'll find information there regarding the remediation fund, special revenue fund, federal funds that are statutorily appropriated to the department, and the summary of spending in those particular areas is there. Additionally, if you look on line 240, is the total spend for the Department of Agriculture under the DE amendment. That would be essentially $203 million in fiscal year 20 and 21. And so that concludes the Department of Agriculture's section of the spreadsheet. I'll go now to the Board of Animal Health. Line 246 and 247 represent change items for the Board of Animal Health. Line 246 is an appropriation for the Farm Servant Oversight Program of $30,000 in the first year and $350,000 in the second year. $350,000 carries forward into the tails biennium. And then line 247 is the Ag Emergency Preparedness and Response. This is identical to the governor's proposal of $250,000 per year, and that is both in 20 and 21 and permanent going into the out years as well. Line 256 are and 257 are non-general fund change items. Line 256 represents the change in fees for the servant inspections. So that'd be additional spending of $179,000 per year in 20 and 21, and then a slight increase in the tails to $185,000 per year. And then line 257 is the servant record keeping electronic forms that Mr. Sullivan referenced at the $6,000 direct appropriation from the Special Revenue Fund to the Board of Animal Health, and that occurs only in 20 and 21 and then does not exist in the tails. And then additionally, there's one small appropriation to AURI. That's on line 272. It's $104,000 in the first year, $107,000 in the second year, and that matches the governor's request for that particular increase for AURI. And lines 279 and 284 are essentially a bracketed table of the total appropriations for various departments within the bill and the total within those on line 284. And then line 287 to the conclusion of the spreadsheet is essentially a record of all of the revenue changes, both non-general fund and general fund, as well as transfers in and out of various funds within the bill. And Madam Chair, that would conclude my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. I know we have people who want to testify. Does anybody have any questions initially? Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to make sure that as everyone knows, I'm new to the committee, so I'm just making sure that I understand the budget as it has been written in previous years and making sure that I understand what's going on. So to Mr. Savory, lines one on page three. So under these February forecast numbers, are these items that were previously in the base budget on lines 153 through 169?
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair, yes. On line 152, you'll see the caption in italics. It just says riders.
Yes.
And those are programs that were in the administration section before that had language that was in the base.
Right.
And then the DE amendment in some cases establishes new riders, and then in most cases establishes new spending for those riders already in law. And so they just changed the numerics, the numbers, the appropriations.
So,
Representative Cleburne.
When I look at this, so the Turf Seed Council was originally in the base, the VDL software, I don't know what that is, but it was also in the base, as were tractor rollovers, the U of M Forever Green, and the Grow It Center. Is that correct?
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, yes, that is correct. Those are essentially line items that have essentially expired, either due to references to the session law. For example, the VDL software, it was established in session law that appropriation would end in 2020 because the university would no longer need the money for the software. It had lived out its useful life, that appropriation specifically. And so that is a reference to that.
Okay. Then I will just register my my sadness and heartbreak that the 905 have been removed from the Forever Green project appropriation.
Any other questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along that same line, you know, the VDL software, the initial request was a $600,000 per year for 3 years for a total of $1.8 million. And it would be nice at some point in time, Madam Chair, to receive an update from the U of M on how that software is, if it's working the way it was originally intended. And I know not today, but eventually. And then the other line on the Grow It Center, that was for that greenhouse over at Metro State. And the same thing, Madam Chair, it'd be nice to hear an update from them on if that project was completed and maybe even a tour, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Good suggestions. All right, so I think we'll bring down testifiers because we do have a number of people who are on the list, and we'll just start with Commissioner Peterson. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Peterson.
Morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Minnesota. Thank you for having me here today and the opportunity to testify on House File or the DE of House File 2200. I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, for your work putting this bill together and getting it to this point. We've had a lot of testimony from people all over the state and many hard work by this committee. With a limited budget, hard decisions have to be made, and my thanks to you for engaging in that difficult process. I'd like to start by thanking you and the members for what's in this bill. When we put our budget together and put things forward, I think about and talk to the department about what are the top issues that keep us up at night, what are the things that we need to do, that we need to take care of. The first thing I want to thank you for is the dollars allocated in this bill that will ensure that Minnesota can continue to develop our international and domestic marketplaces. That's language, I believe, on 4.13. Very important today, we saw that we're sitting on a record amount of soybeans this year, 25% increase over last year. But we also have to look at expanding our domestic markets. And I think that the challenges that we have in the farm country are tough. And we know that with the farm income that was posted last week being all-time low of 23 in the last 23 years. And so I do appreciate that. The bill also, and also in that piece, too, is another in the domestic marketing, you know, we're looking at that, too, as well, that position or that place also could work with our farm-to-school program, and that's something that we've been talking about within the department. So I think that's really an important piece of that part as well. We also appreciate the you continue to invest in our emerging hemp industry, and appreciate Senator Vang's work on that. I can just tell you right now that we're getting close to almost 400 applicants that we have. We get we're still getting applicants every day. It's very challenging and exciting every day to hear all the different people that want to grow hemp. We'll make sure we have a nice map now to see where all the growers are and where all the processors are. And it's very interesting and to hear a lot of the different companies that want to come into Minnesota. Keep in mind with hemp, with the 2018 Farm Bill passing right at the end of the year, I say that we're not in a gold rush, we're in a green rush of hemp right now. Is that North Dakota, Wisconsin, all these different states, companies are looking, should we come to Minnesota? And we think Minnesota is a good place to develop that industry, and so we do appreciate that. The bill also provides additional resources for one of my top priorities to make sure we have enough money to continue to increase our, make sure our meat inspections are done in a timely manner. This is something I continue to hear about is our wait times, and also we just have a lot of people that want to do local processing right now, and I hear it from farmers all over the state that it's just growing as we have more local food processing, and so this bill invests in that, and I appreciate that. It's timely inspections are good for business, and they also ensure proper food safety. Also, MDA, we can leverage those dollars for federal funds, which is always important. This bill also makes smart investments in growing agriculture and protecting our land and our livestock. The money includes, continues to include money that we can continue to battle Palmer amaranth as it grows across the United States and Minnesota. We've been able to battle it successfully, I think. Again, if you look at Iowa, I've said this before, where it's in more than half of the 99 counties. We've been able to limit it to a few counties and eradicate it. And the dollars allocated in this will help us battle that. The other thing I think is extremely important that is in this is the money for the agriculture emergencies. As we face severe threats from not just avian influenza, but our African swine fever that's on the horizon. And so we do appreciate that. It also supports our critical laboratory work needed to detect new plant diseases and insects. That is very important for our lab, and appreciate the people that were able to come over and do our lab. Mental health, other thing that, you know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this committee is understands the importance of that. The House has already taken action on our other piece, and we really appreciate that. But again, seeing the news last week that our farm income, $26,000 average, at a 23-year low, and knowing the hardships that our farmers are facing right now, we appreciate adding that in. In terms of helping our farmers and our neighbors through difficult times, I'm also glad to see the recommendations of the Grain Advisory Task Force that are represented in this bill, and I appreciate that we have had the recommendations of a Grain Advisory Task Force that came together and met a lot of the different farm groups and companies. That and appreciate Representative Anderson for his work on this bill. It's very important as well. Finally, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for your work on the CWD in this bill. It's a very tough issue. I, as I've gotten into this job and visit with my other commissioners in other states, that when we went to D.C. last month and talked about the two big issues that a lot of the states were facing right now with CWD and hemp, because a lot of the people are in the same spot where CWD is expanding in their states, and how do we, you know, some states I feel like, you know, they're in the, are we in a give-up stage on CWD, or is it something that we can continue to battle like we're doing other things? And so I do think that we have tried to work at MDA with the DNR and the Board of Animal Health and are committed to continuing this conversation as we move forward with this language. From our perspective, I'm glad that this committee and Madam Chair yourself, you listened to some of our farmers, and we've kept the authority to regulate cervidae farms with the Board of Animal Health. And I know the moratorium is controversial, but I do appreciate that what we thought was to have a timeline on the moratorium, and this bill ends up at 3 years, and it does allow for a transfer within families during that moratorium time. I'd also like to thank I'd just like to thank the committee for their work, and we look forward to working with you on the process of this bill as it goes through in the coming weeks. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Peterson, you talked about issues that keep you up at night, and in ag we certainly have some of those challenging issues, and one of them that I thought was top priority for our committee was helping our dairy farmers in Minnesota. And it looks as though in this bill we have a $50,000 increase to purchase milk for food shelves. But I talked to the governor at his residence that night, and he seemed to be in favor of some help for dairy farmers. Was that talked about, or I'm disappointed, I guess, that we don't have anything more in here to help dairy. How do you see that, and is there a chance as we move forward?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, appreciate that question because, you know, as I came into this and we put our recommendations forward, we had a couple of weeks to put our recommendations together. And I think that the dairy piece on how to help the dairy farmers, it was tough to look at that because the farm bill had just passed, you know, just right at the end of the year we became, you know, so we started to look at these issues. And I'm glad to see that the House committee, the Jobs Committee, has a pretty big package in that. We have worked to see, like, how that might work and have been talking to the governor to see if that's something that I think we should support, and I'm urging the governor as we move forward to have something like that that we can bridge to the next as farmers sign up for the farm bill, that, you know, a lot of people will say this is going to help us. In the meantime, we've taken some other steps at the department. We have our dairy business planning grants, where we have $50,000 left in that. We want to address that and move that quickly. Unfortunately, too, we also had the barn collapses, too, and I appreciate everybody working to see that. We have had a lot of inquiry on those loans. The other thing that we did, and I hope that you saw and others and the other farm groups help us promote this, is we took a little bit of the agri money that we still had, and we created a program to try to see how to keep some of our dairy farmers that I think what I was really concentrating on as we got into this is who are the dairy farmers we're losing, but are there ones that we can save? And so I saw a lot of issues in talking to some milk inspectors and some of the companies that there are a lot of dairy farmers that teeter right on grade A and fall to grade B. They just get out of milking. But they just are, with the prices and everything, they really can't move forward. And so we, about 3 weeks ago, we did create this loan program to help some of those farmers, give them a one-time bump to do one special project that might help them move forward. So I think that, you know, we're trying to move and figure out what's the best way forward, but those are some of the things we're working on. Thank you.
And just a comment as well, Representative Anderson. So the ag budget is not all-inclusive. What we are trying to do is reach out to some other committees and be able to some other budget areas, and dairy is one of those. So in the jobs and economic development, we do have $10 million to support dairy, and that's to go to farmers that have cows, herds with 750 or fewer in the herd. So I'm hoping that continues to move forward. We also continue to press for increasing the ag specials and doing that in the higher ed bill. So maybe we'll see some, because I know the disappointment on Forever Green is certainly a number of people around the table that have a disappointment about that. So I'm hoping that maybe if we get some ag specials money, we can do something there. We all also have the tax bill that I think we'll see some benefits to agriculture and to farmers in that as well. So I appreciate the question and the suggestion that it's something that it looks to be glaringly missing here, but I think we're trying to address it. So Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you talked about hemp a little bit, and you mentioned processors. I wasn't aware that we had a processing facility in the state. Do we have?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Poston, that is, you know, people that are going to try to, you know, turn it into different pieces, and there can be a lot of different. There's a lot of ideas right now that people, a lot of it does have to do with CBD, I'd say about, I don't know, the heard the latest, but 65 to 70%, that's kind of the market right now. Is the CBD, but a lot of people are trying to figure out the fiber part of it and the seed. And the seed is another, or the is another piece. Can we, you know, because we can't grind it for feed right now, and that's a process that we're looking at or trying to move forward. Because I'm, you know, farmers are going to end up with the biomass part of it, and that's what we need to come along with. I can tell you that there are several companies around the state that are looking at the state and great things we can do with fiber. I had another company contact me yesterday that's already here, that's a well-known company that wants to, you know, they can do that. They can turn hemp into different products, and they want to do that. The Waseca, I don't know, nobody represents Waseca here, but, you know, they had a big forum that Commissioner Place and I were at where they had all their county leaders, and they want to make Waseca the hemp capital of the world. And it's exciting to see some of the companies that they're courting to come in and make, you know, all kinds of products out of it. And so, you know, I've been cautioning farmers, too, about hemp that with almost 250 to 300 growers this year, you know, have a marketplace, you know what you're going to do. And so we'll see, but it is, you know, it is continuing to be a growing issue. And we'll make sure you get the map, because it is almost in everybody's district where it's growing. So, and I do say that there's a lot of There's a lot of corn and soybean farmers that are going to grow hemp this year, you know, because they want to try it. They want to see. I was up in the valley this last week, and I was kind of surprised that some of the farmers say, I'm going to try it this year and then see what I can do.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions for the commissioner? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
We'll bring down the next testifier, Craig Engwall. Welcome to the committee. You just state your name first and then provide your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Craig Engwall, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and I thank you for allowing me to testify here today. The Deer Hunters Association certainly appreciates the efforts of this committee to find some consensus on some of the matters to try to address and fight CWD. It's something we all have a vested interest in, whether we're in agriculture or we're deer hunters. There are many provisions of the bill that we are supportive of, including the double gating provisions, as well as the depopulation of herds that have had an animal test positive for CWD. Our membership does meet annually and discusses in detail some issues, and we came forward with some proposals that go beyond some of the language in the provisions of the delete all amendment, and I would just like to lay some of those out for the committee now to hear and discuss if there are questions. The Deer Hunters membership does support a requirement for double fencing on all captive cervid operations. We do support a program for voluntary buyouts of farms that would like to participate in that. We would call for a prohibition of interstate movement of all cervids, be they wild or captive, and a prohibition on the interstate movement of captive cervid byproducts such as blood and semen. We would call for an elimination of antler point restrictions during the deer hunting season in Minnesota. And for now, lastly, one of the most important things that we feel should happen long-term is the development of a post-mortem rapid CWD test that hunters could use in the field. There are many reasons for this. One, we have to keep hunters engaged, and if CWD becomes endemic or it comes anything like Wisconsin, we have real fears. And we've seen some of those things playing out in southeast Minnesota already where we've lost hunters. But two, it would have the opportunity to prevent that meat, if there was an infected deer, from getting in the stream of food through locker plants, etc. And it would let us identify things more quickly and dispose of those carcasses. So we really are in favor of funding to develop a postmortem quick test. And knowing the limitations on time here today, I'd be happy to stand for some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Engwall. Any questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Engwall, do you have any numbers on your membership on how many butcher their own deer and how many use a commercial processor?
Mr. Engwall.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that would be anecdotal. We have a lot of members who process their own deer, and I would guess at least half. That's just based on my experiences around most. It can depend on where our members are. If they're in the Twin Cities, they typically will bring it to a processor. If they're in rural Minnesota like I am, they typically do it themselves. But I'd say it's a strong half probably would process their own.
Thank you, Mr. Engwall. Representative Lua.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, are the Deer Hunter Association satisfied with the current restrictions on moving deer carcasses for any reason around within the state and from that perspective, because obviously there's a concern that a carcass, if it was infected, could accidentally spread the disease. I'm talking about wild killed deer, nothing to do with farmed animals.
Madam Chair, Representative Luick, it's our position that all movement of cervids, wild or farmed, are of a concern. And so for DNR to enforce the movement of cervids from other states, in talking to the experts, trying to keep all cervids where they are is one of the key things. So how we handle wild deer harvested by hunters is very important. And working on measures, whether it's the dumpster provisions that are being heard in the Senate right now as we are here, there can be a number of measures that limit the movement of cervids, be they wild or captive.
Representative Lewick.
Oh, thank you. I see some recommendations here relative to live captive animals, but I still don't see anything hard and fast here on exactly what the deer hunters would recommend that they impose upon themselves. So, but you know, that's certainly a concern because you know, we don't want that disease to be moved around in any way, shape, or form. But anyway, appreciate that. But I would ask that as a member of your association, that the association continue to look inward, very specifically at the things that deer hunters can do here to help this process. Thank you.
Mr. Engwall.
Madam Chair, Representative Lewick, and we will do that in terms of handling deer in the field, et cetera. But I will note that our membership has called for restriction on interstate movement of all cervids, including wild. So, and that's a controversial one amongst hunters because if we want to reestablish elk in Minnesota or other things, this would limit that. And so we are looking beyond just the captive issue.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lewick, you can, in about an hour and 45 minutes, you can hear the walkthrough in the Environment Committee.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much for
Thank
coming
you,
forward,
Madam Chair and members.
I think next on our list is Mr. Quillis. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Tony Quillis representing the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association, and thank you for the time. As Mr. Engwall has mentioned, we're across the street also on this subject at the same time, so I will be brief and just quickly to touch on the questions that Representative Lewick had and Representative Hansen and Mr. Engwall were talking about. There is current importing hunter-harvested cervid right now in rule. That rule is going to expire in August, so working with the DNR to see if we can contain that rule or maybe even put it in statute, Representative Lewick. But, Madam Chair, to the DE4 and specifically Article 2, to just touch on a couple of things, just to reiterate again some concern about the fence deficiencies and the escapes in Section 1. I just wanted to bring those to your attention. Again, we talked about how tough the winter was down in southern Minnesota, and now, unfortunately, some flooding that we're looking at. Those would be just two instances there that would trigger. So I just to put that out there for conversation, Madam Chair. In Section 2, we have talked about, for newborn animals, we had talked about various dates, and now at within 24 hours of birth, we'd like to have a further conversation about that. I think that might be a little tough for our folks to do, but I wanted to point that out for your consideration, Madam Chair. The next one that I'd like to touch on very quickly is Section 6, which is 37.14 to 37.15, which is essentially a lifetime ban for any registration who is revoked, Madam Chair. So if we could have a further discussion around that, Madam Chair. And then Section 7, currently right now, if there is a movement of animals, it's 14 days report, and it's down to 48 hours. And so I just, we're in discussing with the people that I represent, trying to figure out what happens over weekends, holidays. If you move something Friday afternoon, can we get to it by Monday? So to have a further discussion around that 48 hours. And then my interpretation of the if an animal anywhere in a farm cervid herd has found a test positive, that we essentially have a lockdown on the state. And if one of these animals happens to be found in southern Minnesota and one of our facilities in northern Minnesota has a contract to move it to
another facility in Michigan or Iowa, how this would affect that. So just some things I want to throw out for your consideration, Madam Chair, as we're working through this. Also, when we talk about the chronic wasting disease vectors, I'd like to work with the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Natural Resources and make sure that those vectors include taxidermy and hunter-harvested imported carcasses, if we're going to talk about vectors that could be the cause of a positive in one of the farms. Madam Chair, then I think it just happened when we eliminated the indemnification fund that we talked about before, about when a herd tests positive, it says within a reasonable amount of time, the herd must be euthanized, but if somebody's in that reimbursement process with the federal government, how would we interpret that reasonable amount of time? So I just again, things for your consideration there, and in that indemnification process to make sure that there's reimbursement for the facility. And then finally, Madam Chair, on the notification of the sell or transfer of property, would that include, I'm assuming, it's the owner of a premise where chronic wasting disease is detected. That would include private land also. Madam Chair, thank you for the time, and would stand for any questions around every day, all day, for you to come back and testify, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. I don't see any questions around the table. I appreciate
thank you, Madam Chair.
Your testimony. We do have next on the list Lorna Schmidt. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lorna Schmidt. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association, and I'm here today on behalf of partners of the Good Food Access Coalition. We know that many difficult decisions were made as this budget was assembled, so we want to make sure that we thank you for prioritizing a reinvestment in the Good Food Access Fund this year. With hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans struggling to access healthy, affordable food, and as you heard earlier this session, with trends in rural grocery store closures threatening to make the problem worse, the need to do more to address Minnesota's food access challenges is urgent. Your investment will ensure that the progress we've made with the Good Food Access Fund continues, supporting farmers, grocers, and other small food retailers in need of financial and technical assistance. The severity of Minnesota's food access challenges vary across regions of the state, however, and communities facing the greatest need, we continue to see a financing gap between the capital required to establish or preserve a retail food operation and the capital that's actually available. As negotiations continue this session, we hope to continue working with you to explore additional opportunities to further strengthen this investment. The Good Food Access Fund is important to health, but it also benefits local economies and creates market opportunities for Minnesota producers, making it an all-around smart investment. We thank you for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. I don't see any questions. Thank you. I have David Schaefer. Welcome to the committee. State your name and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Schaefer. I'm with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We're a 501c6 trade group that represents about 110 different solar companies throughout the state. This includes rooftop installers, community solar garden developers, and pretty much everyone else that's interested in solar. So first off, I just want to say thank you very much to the chair for including the community solar garden study in this bill. It's going to be a really great step in the right direction to making sure we totally understand all the benefits that solar provides to the land. And I want to thank Representative Hansen for bringing the underlying bill, which is House File 1796. For the first time ever that we're aware of, money from the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Program will be used to study community solar or any renewable technology. This is really an amazing step in the right direction. When I started at Mencia in about 2013, there were about 35 megawatts of solar in the entire state. And to give you an idea, if you took all the panels off all the roofs, put them in a field, a megawatt's about 8 to 10 acres. So there are about 350 acres of solar in the state of Minnesota just about 6 years ago. Today we're up to about a gigawatt, so that's about 10,000 acres of solar in the state, and probably about 80-90% of it, I would guess, is on ag land. So very quickly here, solar is becoming almost a crop in this state, so studying it is incredibly important. So first of all, yeah, thank you very much for including it. But the part that wasn't included in this bill was the contiguous county requirement, which would allow for gardens to go on really throughout the state. Right now, gardens are required to sort of be in the counties that are contiguous with the metro area. This has to do with just a kind of arcane rule that was put into the community solar garden program originally. It's sort of arbitrary and really amounts to this to the disparity of gardens just being close to the metro area. If we're really going to study the effects of community solar throughout the state, we might as well get rid of the contiguous county provision as well so that we can measure soil improvements throughout all of Xcel service territory so that we can measure the net benefits to these communities in the form of financial assistance. If we don't remove the contiguous county requirement, then we're not going to be studying enough to get enough value out of the study. So it's very clear to me that solar is becoming part of the ag economy the same way that grain silos are, irrigation equipment, tractors, and I hope we use the opportunity to study solar as if it's having the same effect as those technologies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. And just a comment about the contiguous county issue. The part about the community solar gardens and the farmer benefit, that seemed to fit within agriculture. The contiguous county seems to fit within the energy committee. So I'm assuming that there'll be discussion there. And if not, you could bring that to the attention there, because I think that's probably when it comes to the energy production and where those things are. So I just wanted to make that comment. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, one of the benefits talked about with these solar community gardens in the rural areas is habitat benefit. And I get that if we're talking about pollinator habitat, but there's a couple of these out in my area, and one in particular I would mention it's an area that's fairly close to a wetland, some water and such. And now around this solar garden is a chain link fence. So to me, that would impede, well, keep deer from getting in there, for example, to utilize the habitat. So would you agree there's some trade-offs in terms of habitat development in rural areas with these community solar gardens?
Mr. Schaefer.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. You know, the growth of community solar has been so explosive that I think a lot of what we've been hearing this session in this committee and elsewhere is, we like solar, we just want it to be in the right spots and done the right ways. And so I think we're still trying to figure out exactly what the habitat changes are for folks. And that, to me, is kind of the purpose of some of this study, is to start to figure out where's the best place to actually put these gardens and how do we want to do them.
All right. I don't see any other questions. Thank you for your testimony. And I know we have some more people that signed up. So Patrick Murray. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Patrick Murray. I'm the Senior Government Affairs Director for Cooperative Network. We're a two-state trade association of over 250 co-op members in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Many of our co-op members are the Farm Supply Cooperative members, and the specific legislation I'd like to speak about contained in this bill is Article 3 and 4, which are some modifications to the Grain Buyers Act and the Grain Storage Act. These were a result of the legislation that was introduced by Representative Anderson, House File 915, that was amended in committee on Thursday, March 21st. So culmination of the work that was done by the Green Advisory Task Force, which Commissioner Peterson mentioned earlier, Cooperative Network has participated with this group. I think there's been four or five of these task force meetings that we've had since last fall as a result of the elevator failures in Porter and Ashby. So we appreciate the leadership of the department bringing together a whole host of stakeholder groups, including Cooperative Network, to try to come up with some weights so that we can provide some of these farmers that are out there that are having some issues, obviously, with getting their dollars back from the elevator that they're selling their grain to. So it's a very serious issue, a sensitive issue, and we're happy that the result of that was all the stakeholder groups getting together, and the department was able to synthesize these recommendations. So, again, these are what you'll see in Articles 3 and 4, and, again, we appreciate the committee bringing this forward. I also would like to say that Laura Lemke, who's the new executive director of the Minnesota Green and Beet Association, apologizes she was not able to be here today, but yesterday was her first day officially on the job with Bob Zelenka, now retired, and Laura's out hosting grain grading schools in the country this week. So on behalf of MGFA, also they were part of the group, and I would just like to, again, thank you all for bringing this together, including this language in the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you for coming forward. I think next we have Mr. Egger, Paul Egger. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Egger. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors. We're a trade association with over 20,000 real estate professionals across the state as our membership. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I actually didn't intend to be here this morning when I arrived at the office, but I did see some language in your bill and had an opportunity to check in with Ms. Conley and just wanted to put some comments on the record briefly. Madam Chair, the reason I'm here is the language in the Farm Survey article, and specifically the language on page 38, lines 18 through 21, regarding the seller disclosure provision. And Mr. Quill has touched on this, but this provision creates a seller disclosure requirement for Farm Survey premises where chronic wasting disease is detected. We have a few concerns with that provision that I'd like to highlight for the committee, and we're happy to work with you and the stakeholders as the bill moves forward. But, Madam Chair, the language simply creates the requirement for the seller to disclose the information, but it doesn't touch on other issues that are common with seller disclosure requirements. For example, what if the disclosure is not provided to the buyer? And when you're thinking about the situation of the current owner, when CWD is detected, it seems obvious that that owner would know to provide that disclosure to the buyer. But if you think, you know, 3-4 sellers down the road or 10-15 years later, it's very possible that information gets lost in translation and that a disclosure is not provided at some point. And so, for example, in residential real estate, it's a requirement to provide to the best of the owner's or the seller's knowledge the condition of the property, and this creates just a straight disclosure. There's also a question, this does not contemplate any kind of liability if there's a disclosure that's not provided or if it's an incomplete disclosure. And also there is not, this doesn't contemplate any kind of a statute of limitations. So is it, you know, is there a period of time by which you would be able to address any issues that arise from the disclosure not being provided? And finally, there's a provision, I think, that you touched on earlier on page 37 regarding the transferring from the herd from family member within a family. Just want to point out that as I read the seller disclosure requirement, this does not create any kind of exemption if you're transferring the property from one family member to the next, so this would apply to those transfers as well. Madam Chair, I we're happy to work with you and the other stakeholders as this moves forward. I guess at this time we would recommend to you and the committee to set this provision aside and to keep working on it. We certainly want to avoid any unintended consequences moving forward associated with any kind of liability that may be created if the language isn't kind of well structured and well thought out. And finally, Mr. Quillis, his interpretation of that provision is different than the way I read it. And certainly if this would apply to any kind of property beyond premises that are owned and operated for Farm Survey, that would make this a much bigger issue that we certainly need more discussion about. With that, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. We do have a question. Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. And that was my question on lines 38.18 through 38.21. Does this language only pertain to Farm Survey? or if I owned an 80 acres of land and harvested a deer during deer hunting season and it tested positive, would that 80 then follow underneath this definition? So that would be my question. Is that the way the testifier interprets it as well?
Mr. Ager.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, again, as I said, I think I read this language differently than Mr. Quillis. The way I read this language, it says the owner of a premises where chronic wasting disease is detected must disclose in writing to the buyer transferee the date of depopulation and the requirements incumbent upon the premises. So this is tied to the requirements, again, as I read it in paragraph E above, which are requirements that are placed on the owner of a premises where farms surveyed a premises. So that's the way I read it, but I certainly think if you're going to move forward with any language, it should be clarified that, you know, you could insert, you know, on line 18, owner of a, and then after a, farm surveyed, insert farm surveyed a, and that would make it clear in the language.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ager, I think, you know, your questions kind of raise the concern of why we need to be concerned about CWD. A lot of the testimony is about how our reaction to CWD is impacting people rather than our reaction to how CWD is going to impact people. So we've had testimony that we really don't know how long the prions last. Could be 5 years, could be 10 years. So the question is, how long do you keep it? Mm-hmm. We don't know how long they will last. So then what happens with a community who buys land, you know, maybe 10 years after a site was vacated and they had plans for it and they cannot bring livestock in there or they can't bring people there? Those are, I think your questions actually prove the point of how serious this is. And Representative Hamilton, whether it's on private land, whether it's because it's wild deer that was found, this shows the need why we have to do strong measures to contain these outbreaks, because we don't know what the long-term resilience of this disease is.
Well, and Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think you raise a very good point, and the other body has kind of a different approach on this in some areas, but one of the questions that we've had is if there are going to be requirements on the land in, you know, forever potentially, how does that information, how is that information going to be made available to the owner 50 years from now? And that we ensure that it's accurate information, that that owner of property at that time down the road understands what their obligations are under the law. And so I think there needs to be kind of more time spent to what's the best way to accomplish that goal. And again, we're happy to be part of that discussion.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ager, well, if I sell property and I have a well on it, I have to disclose it to the seller. That's the responsibility that we have in law. There's plenty of precedent for seller and buyer disclosure on things, and that's for public health, that they know that there's a well there, that that well, if it's active or inactive or if it needs to be capped, and maybe as a seller before I sell it, I have to cap it. Those are responsibilities that the legislature has taken through law to protect public health. So I think you may want to look at our well code as a model here in terms of this, in terms of disclosure, rather than having a deed restriction that is going on the property. You could do both. I think where the committee was is that we were looking at a model that would be a responsibility of the seller and buyer, that there's plenty of precedent already existing for.
Mr. Ager.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think we're saying different things. I think what we're advocating is just let's be thoughtful about the best way to provide the information to those that need to have it. And creating the obligation, Representative Hansen, today for things that need to be disclosed 50 years from now, we want to make sure that that information is conveyed 50 years from now in the way that the legislature intends. And again, it's easy to think about an owner of property now and their obligation to a buyer tomorrow, but it's a lot harder to think about how we make sure that the information is made available in a manner that's usable and understandable to an owner 50 years from now, if that's what an obligation is going to be.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. I think we have another question. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this part of the bill is very important, but I think goes beyond the scope of the Ag Committee. Mr. Eggert, I don't know if you're a lawyer or not, but could you give us a layman's definition of what premises is, means?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I am not a lawyer, so I am not going to get over my skis on trying to define what premises would be in this scenario. I'm not sure if there's a definition earlier in the article for farm survey premises, but again, I think it gets back to the item that Mr. Quillis touched on and that Representative Hamilton brought up a few minutes ago, and I think that needs some more work in terms of tightening up the language to make sure that it's clear to everybody who it's going to apply to.
Representative Anderson.
Well, we sit here and think about what ifs, but looking at the language and say a hunter bagged a deer and sent it in for a test and brought that deer home, hung it in his garage, or took it to a locker plant, and then that deer test turns out to be a positive, would that impact the locker plant or the hunter's home and garage in terms of being having this encumbrance on his deed for what time period? So, yeah, there's a lot of things I think that would pertain to this particular section of the bill, Madam Chair, and I think it goes beyond the purview of this committee.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks for the testimony. Next we're going to Mr. Pearson, Jim Pearson. And actually, you can state your name because it may be different from what I just stated. So, please, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rick Evans with XL Energy, and I'm sitting in for Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Evans.
Appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly about Article 1, Section 23, which is the Community Solar Gardens Program. First of all, very much appreciate that this committee is not taking up the contiguous county requirement. I can assure you it was not arcane. It was not arbitrary. It goes to the very heart of the program. It is getting a full and robust debate in the Energy Committee, which is where it belongs. The Community Solar Garden Program, in addition to being extremely expensive, is becoming more and more controversial, and I think the Energy Committee is exactly the place for that to be dealt with. I do want to make a few comments about the study, however, because I think that, first of all, studying is always good. It's always good to get the facts. I'd like to suggest to the committee that you might want to broaden the study somewhat. The thing about community solar gardens is, at least in the XL Energy program, is that it is not a broad-based system. It is a very narrow system. And, in fact, it restricts where solar gardens can go. And under no circumstances are solar gardens ever going to be able to be put anywhere in the state. They're going to go into the very tiny little slivers of the state where XL Energy happens to have service territory. On the other hand, it's important for the committee to know that our belief is, and I think the resource plan we file in July will reflect this, solar is becoming or will become the cheapest resource in Minnesota for energy within the next 5 or 10 years. And we intend, XL Energy, and I think the other utilities will as well, intend to greatly expand our use of solar energy. And those solar panels can indeed go anywhere in the state. That will go to the benefit of property owners, whether they're in XL service territory or not. And so it's important when you're studying this to realize that by only studying community solar gardens, you are studying tiny little slivers of the state where these solar gardens can go. And I believe in the next year or two, this committee may realize that they want to study how we're going to deploy solar across the state in not hundreds of megawatts, but thousands of megawatts across the state. So I would encourage you, as you think about studying how agriculture land can benefit from the deployment of solar, that you expand your study beyond the very restricted area of community solar gardens and look at the entire state of Minnesota and the utility-scale solar revolution that we believe is right around the corner. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I don't see any questions, so thank you, Mr. Evans. Thank you. And so is it a yes? Yes, Mr. Sprecht. Okay, thank you. I think we have a couple more people on the list, but so welcome to the committee. Appreciate you coming forward, and please state your name and provide the testimony.
Madam Chair and members, Tim Sprecht representing the Minnesota Deer Farmers today. I'm going to try not to replow any ground that Mr. Quillis plowed in the Ag Committee, but just want to draw your attention to a few items within Article 2. Some of them we may have spoken about in a previous committee, but I just want to draw your attention. On line 35.5, we're thankful that we have an opportunity to choose between two different types of fencing, but we are concerned about existing farms that have spent a considerable amount of money putting in compliant fencing that's in good standing and has passed inspection, that now the goalposts may be moving to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. So we want to hopefully maybe if we could change this language a little bit so that it's moving forward on the implementation of this piece, that would be very helpful for us. On the newborns and tagging, I believe there's someone here that wants to make a couple of brief comments that may also be able to answer questions, but we can have some additional discussions internally about this. The concern that we have is not only with the weaning of the animals, but also the size of the ears on these small fawns. And if you're going to intend to tag with a compliant, statutorily compliant tag, which is called a panel tag, the tags are too large and the ears can't support them. So we would need to have additional discussion there. Madam Chair, a couple of minor comments. Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave my comments there for now. I'm happy to meet with anyone at any time. We're concerned, obviously, that the realtors have questions about the disclosure piece, so I will pledge to work with them to come up with language that works for their needs, works for the committee's needs, and also addresses the needs of the deer farmers. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speck. I don't see any questions, but I just wanted to comment. I through this process, discovered that I have a deer farm in my district, and I have had the opportunity to go and see them on last Sunday afternoon, and so that was an educational opportunity, and certainly they provided some insight, and one of the things was just the 24-hour time for tagging, and they said that's what they do. And after the newborn is with their mother for maybe about 12 hours, then they come in and they do some shots and do some tagging and do that process. And I also, you know, a lot of this is Representative Becker Finn's kind of base on this bill. And so she also was suggesting about the National Deer Farmers Association to go to their website, and I was able to do that, and I see that they provide best practices as the tagging at that time. So I'm thinking if we don't have the right tags, maybe that's part of what we should be doing. But it was, and the elk may be different, I don't know. So it's maybe three steps forward, two steps back, continuing in this process. And I appreciate that the people who are most concerned about this issue are engaged in the process. I think the deer farmers are certainly engaged, the deer hunters, DNR, Board of Animal Health, Department of Ag, everybody who knows the issue and has some concerns about different aspects of it. And now we understand realtors as well. So I think that's important to keep bringing forward ideas and trying to move this. As I said previously, CWD is the issue. You know, that's the villain here, and we need to figure out how do we address the villain and not villainize people who are working in the industry, either as deer farmers or benefiting from the deer that roam free and that they are the hunters. So any suggestions and ongoing conversation, I appreciate that, and thank you. And did somebody have a question over here? No, I don't see any. So thank you for coming
forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We do have now Brendan Jordan. Hello, Mr. Jordan. Welcome to the committee.
Uh, Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute. I represent the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota, and appreciate the opportunity to speak with the committee today regarding the omnibus bill. First of all, I'd just like to offer a thank you for continued support for the bioincentive program, which is included in Section 20, Subdivision 4 on page 32. The bioincentive program is really intended to make Minnesota a leader in bio-based chemical production, advanced biofuel production, and biomass thermal energy. It's a tool, it's a recruitment tool for attracting new projects and attracting reinvestment in existing facilities, which can include ethanol and biodiesel, reinvestment in forest products industry facilities, and organic waste. For those who are not familiar with the program, this is a performance-based incentive. So there's sort of a couple different ways that states approach this task of trying to attract new companies in this area. A lot of states will offer upfront funding in terms of grants and loans. The risk there is that you can offer a lot of upfront funding and never get it back and not get a project. This program does not carry that risk. The only way a company receives an incentive is if they build a facility and produce something. The statute in that was passed in 2015, it provides very clear guidance for the amount of incentive that a facility receives if they are up and running. It is sort of this program has been very useful for people doing economic development for DEED and the Department of Agriculture and the Iron Ranges Resources and Rehabilitation Department. The fly in the ointment here with this program is if you're not going to offer upfront money, companies really are apprehensive about whether the funding will be there when they do actually build a facility and start producing. And so it is also always difficult to estimate the correct amount of funding. This program has grown slowly since 2015. Typically, it has been appropriated at $1.5 million a year. I think there's a good reason to expect that the draw on the program will exceed that in the next 2 years. If that happens, if there is inadequate money for the program, that creates some risk. Really two kinds of risk. One is that a company that has already made an investment and expects to receive payment will not receive that payment because there's too many companies lined up for the program. The other risk is that companies will see that there's inadequate funding and a company that may be considering an investment will not make that investment. And there is, in particular, one potentially large investment that's being considered in Cloquet, Minnesota, to reinvest at an existing forest products industry facility. But there, you know, existing facilities producing bio-based chemicals are potentially at risk of not receiving the funding they expect. Madam Chair and members, I appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk about this, and again, appreciate continued support for this program and the statement that it is becoming a permanent part of the Department of Ag budget, which is exciting, and I think it shows strong support for this growing industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. I don't see any questions. Appreciate your testimony. And I know that's the end of our list, but we do have other people who may be wanting to come forward, and I'm assuming that maybe people have positioned themselves to do that. So please come forward. You can state your name and provide your testimony. I appreciate it.
Madam Chair, this is thank you and the members of the committee. My name is Rich Meach. I'm president of the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association, also a director of the North American Deer Farmers Association. This is pertaining to Article 2 in the farm survey. I'm going to be very brief here. My issue is on 37.2, the moratorium. Like I said, I'm going to be brief. Any moratorium prohibits one vector of our ability to do commerce, and eventually that's the starvation of our business. So we're not in favor of any moratorium. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. And state your name, please.
Hi, my name's Sue Mate. Thank you, Madam Chairman, Chair, and members. I just want to touch on the 3522 identification. I know you touched on that a little bit about the ear tags. I understand the 24-hour thing, but that's not always possible. If you have, we need our does to have that time to bond with their fawns, and especially if they have quads, their ears are so tiny that within that 24-hour period of time, there's just, we just can't do that. So as they get a few days older, we can get that done. And then there's times that we can't put those large tags in their ear. Sometimes the mother will pull them out. So after they're weaned is the time that we do that larger tag. But my concern is putting those smaller tags in, you can't always see them at 50 yards, you know, like it's stated in there. And we don't want anyone coming on our property and destroying our animals because they can't read that fawn's tag at 50 yards. So I don't.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's helpful information. Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Meach or Mrs. Meach? All right. I see no questions. Thank you. Anyone else that wanted to testify? And so, again, please come down. If you just state your name.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Gary Olson. I'm a director of the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association, and I also am a member of the United States Animal Health Association, where I serve on the Wildlife Disease Committee for the last 5 years. There's one point here I'd like to look at, number 38.6. If an animal is farmed, farm certified herd tests positive for chronic wasting disease, the entire herd must be euthanized and disposed of. That's some language there that's kind of lagging behind the science of what we're finding out about CWD. We're looking at live testing that we last in October of 2017 at United States Animal Health. We voted unanimously at our assembly to approve the live test, which is going to be coming out in the next standards program from USDA, which will be released this spring sometime. So to kill a whole herd off for an animal that we could actually probably go in and live test and remove suspect animals, it just doesn't make sense. Because if you remove a whole herd, that's going to involve a taking with some sort of indemnification, which is going to cost somebody, the state or USDA, quite a lot of money. And we're also working on genetic resistant animals and looking at gene editing. The genetic resistance, we're working in Wisconsin right now. There are several herds over there, hunting preserves that are positive, that are staying in business, and they are seeing definite results with genetic resistant lines. And actually, I tested all my doe lines last year to monitor for those, and I don't want to get too detailed into it, but there are certain bloodlines that are very low susceptible, and looks like we could have some actually resistant lines. The other thing, too, is we also voted last year at United States Animal Health to start testing for strains of CWD. So to go in and kill whole herds when there could be various strains, Norway actually found several strains of CWD. So we need the response should be more into the science, not, you know, to kill everyone. You know, just like with the bird flu situation, you know, with high path, you killed all the birds, but low path, we didn't hear about it last year with the low path. So, and I hear so many different other comments, you know, from the prions and stuff and tying up in the soils and that. I've been involved in several depopulations of farms. I've had my hands on almost 300 positive animals, so I know what a positive animal does and doesn't do. And we've been involved in soil testing. I mean, you always hear about the environmental issues. We don't know. We know there's an environmental factor, but we don't know where it is. We've done soil tests on heavily infected farms and not found anything. So, you know, there's just a lot of questions, a lot of what we don't know. We're making rules and laws on stuff that we really don't understand here, that it's hard to work these things backwards once they're in place and in legislation. And I think if we just hold off for a couple of years here, there's the science is catching up really fast in what we're doing on the USDA side. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. I think we have a question. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's where I'm wondering, you know, we had this debate a little bit with the Board of Animal Health about being forward-thinking as the tests are developed. We do have a precedence around the state where we've done live testing on different diseases. And then we were able to call out the positives and then eventually come back and be able to test out of being quarantined, if you will. And the state has also had great success with the Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health creating zones throughout the state. And so you're able to, in some areas, you'd be quarantined. You wouldn't be able to move animals, and rightfully so. But other areas, because it's a big state, obviously, you're not restricted like the areas that are infected. So, Madam Chair, I would like to visit with you a little more offline. And if we could create some language that people could be comfortable with, I would like to be able to bring that forward. Again, we have a number of precedents set throughout the state on different diseases, so I'd like to talk to you a little more about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Thank you. I don't think that was a question to Mr. Olson, but did, so thank you. I think we have another testifier, so Mr. Clavin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin. I represent the Minnesota Turf Seed Council today, and you can tell I had not planned to speak given the lack of tie today, Madam Chair, but I took a poll of my colleagues up there. No one's jumped up to thank you for the agreed and agri funding levels that you have in the bill. I think the commissioner may have mentioned it, and we worked with you on those funding levels back when you chaired in 13 and 14, and of course with Representative Hamilton as well. So just a note for members, we appreciate the AgReet funding being 9.3 each year as it was in 2017. We notice an increase in AgReet as well, 1.88 million each year. So I want to thank you for that. Specifically, to make a pitch for the Turf Seed Council, it was mentioned before. You'll see a bunch of the pass-through sections starting on page 10. There's a couple new at the beginning, but when you hit the county fairs and livestock breeders and northern crops on page 11, all those have been here for many, many, many years, including the turf seed. And so that was not included in here. I think there was a writer last biennium, that said it was one time. And so that got a little confusing. Commissioner Peterson came in as the budget was pretty much assembled, and so he didn't have a chance to put that in. It may fit, Madam Chair, if you're tied up under all your pass-throughs. I was looking at the agri funding, and the increase, as I mentioned, is $1.883 million a year. If you were to fund the Turf Seed Council out of just the increase in agri, that would be 5.74% of just the increase. So there may be some room to do that in there. I think it could fit if you look at line 7.35. There's on-farm research, which is what the Turf Seed Council does. And probably more importantly, on 8.3, the department is already authorized in this rider to use it for crop research. And again, that's what the Turf Seed Council does up north. And so there may be some room there within the agri if we were to do a carve-out by Thursday, but I just wanted to go on the record making a pitch for that funding. And on behalf of my colleagues, thank you for the levels in the bill.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. I don't see any questions. Thank you, Mr. Clavin. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on any aspect of this bill, for or against, concerns? I don't see anyone else. So what we'll be doing, there's perhaps a number of things that people have discussed here that might have initiated some thoughts regarding amendments. We do have a requirement to try to get the amendments done by 9:45 tomorrow morning. That's our goal. I think that that's really what we have in mind. I know that sometimes we might be looking at things if it's an oral amendment on something. You know, we do make some adjustments there. But our hope is that if you have amendments, that they're in written form and that they're available before 9:45 tomorrow morning. And then on Thursday, we will be going through and amending House File 2200 with the DE4 and amendments as people have them. So today I'm going to lay over House File 2200. I appreciate the discussion today. I appreciate, again, the thoughtfulness. I know people are very engaged on a number of topics, and I really do appreciate that you're thinking through what we can be doing and should be doing, and I appreciate that on behalf of agriculture and our farmers, both beginning farmers and those traditional, long-term, forever here farmers. So I appreciate all that. And with that, I'm going to adjourn the meeting.